Hey, greetings, Internet. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and entrepreneurs looking to grow, not only by learning new things, but by connecting their work to big ideas and overcoming the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. Welcome to episode 161. Pushing the World Forward with Jason Langsdorf. Jason is a developer, designer, speaker, and friendly bear emoji at Gatsby, a company whose mission is to make building websites fun and create tools that increase the performance of the web. In this episode of Getting Work to Work, we talk about how he found his voice, the power of stories to highlight experiences and emphasize context, moving from screwing up publicly to embracing public feedback, and his big idea of pushing the world forward by improving web performance in the developing world. Show notes and links for this episode can be found at gwtw.co/161. Getting Work to Work is brought to you by Chris Martin Studios, a media production company telling stories with heart, edge, and fearlessness for those who dare to build a better world. Keep in touch with Chris Martin Studios by signing up for the Curiosity Lab, my weekly email newsletter at gwtw.co/161. All right, you ready for this interview with Jason? Let's get into it. Jason, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. Why don't you start by introducing yourself and share a little about what you do?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm Jason Langsdorf. I currently work at Gatsby as a developer and kind of a teacher. Like I write and teach people how to use it.
Oh, cool.
And I came up as being kind of a Mr. Fix-It developer. I started an agency myself, had to figure out how to do all that, and then went from that to being a contractor to working at IBM for a while as a front-end architect, and then most recently, in early this year, made the jump to Gatsby.
Awesome. There's so many kind of routes that we could go in this interview. We could talk about technology. We could talk about what you really enjoy talking about, it seems, on your blog, which is that personal touch. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I thought would be a great start is something that stood out on your website was your sense of humor and almost the real way that you talk about life and work. And so I guess the question that I have to start is, was there a moment where you had to make a conscious shift from what you thought people wanted to hear to just being yourself?
So I think I was very fortunate in that, in high school, the only subject that interested me was English. And so during the course of my high school career, I took basically every English class that my school offered, which unfortunately it was a small school, so there weren't that many, but I had a couple really good teachers who would push me to write, and they would really call me out if they felt like I was writing something that wasn't me. And so I got a lot of good education that way. And I also was very fortunate that people kept pushing books on me that were very authentically written books. So writers like you, I mean, I'm going to call these out and everybody can argue whether or not they think they're good authors, but you know, you read something like Hemingway, you read something like Chuck Palahniuk, who despite all of his other flaws has this very authentic and interesting voice. And then you read people like, oh God, there's so many, but so, you know, you start to read these and you look at your own writing and you start to think like, okay, I can just write something that's like canned and sanitized and safe, but it's not going to reflect me. It's going to be a statement that is just true, and you can argue whether or not it's true, but you can't really like connect with it. And as a result, I've shied very much away from trying to create doctrine. And instead I try to teach by just talking about the ways that I've screwed up or made my life hard and tell the story. Like, okay, so here's the thing that I did. It really made everything terrible. I realized what was making it terrible. I read this brilliant thing from this person or this brilliant thing from this person. And here's the experiment I did. And here's how it made my life better. And maybe that'll give you a starting point to make something in your life better as well. And so I think it's that approach of I don't offer advice. I tell stories. Mm-hmm. And I hope that that is easier for people because it doesn't feel like they're being told what to do. It just feels like, you know, a buddy at a bar telling you a story about a thing that they tried that worked. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I really answered your question.
No, you did, because you're speaking to this idea. I really like how you worded it. You know, I'm not creating doctrine. I'm telling stories so that you can find what you need in those stories for yourself. And I think that's a really, I think that's really cool. And I think that's very admirable for what we need in this world right now.
Well, thank you. I think I have always learned best when somebody just shares their experience. I'm very much the type of person that, like, I have to learn from my own mistakes. I don't learn from the mistakes of others. But what, you know, I'm especially prone, like, you know, especially when I was younger, if you told me that something was a bad idea, I didn't hear that and think, oh, I should make my life easier by not doing that. You would tell me it was a bad idea, and I would say, well, I should find out why. So I would take on these huge, just completely hopeless tasks of trying to, like, you know, one of my first programming goals was to build something to replace WordPress. Mm. And, you know, everybody was like, well, you shouldn't try to replace established software. And I was like, well, let's find out why, you know? And, you know, so I'm like 19 years old thinking I can outpace this community of like thousands of open source contributors because, you know, the hubris of being 19.
Right.
And so I had to learn that from my own mistake. And I think in places where I have not made those types of mistakes, it was because somebody told me a story and they showed me why it was a bad idea. They created context around this concept. So it wasn't some cliche or some like cute little anecdote that just has a moral and no substance. It was mostly substance and very little moral. It was, here's a story about a thing I did, and you can take from that what you will. And it helps me, when I hear things like that, it helps me kind of internalize them and approach them from an angle that's very personal to me. So I feel like I did the work. I made the decision. I'm not taking your advice blindly, which is, you know, that kind of clashes with the type of personality I have. But if you tell me a story and I go, oh, okay, so he did this because of this, and then this happened, I can make a decision now on how I'm going to act in the future. And it feels like I did that. It doesn't feel like you said, oh, don't do that. I tried it. It's terrible. You know, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. How does that work when you go into your job and the things that you do for a living, whether it's developing software or teaching people how to do whatever it is that they do?
So in the cultural part, I use exactly the same format. I just tell stories. Here's a way that my agency, the reason I'm not still at my agency is because I made just every managerial poor decision you can make. And I learned a lot about what I am not good at and the areas that I need to focus on to be a good manager. And I also just learned that I probably shouldn't be a manager. I'm much better in like a technical leadership than a people leadership position. So as a result, I've always moved more toward architecture or teaching versus managing and mentoring. It's just, you know, I'm better that way. When it comes to technical stuff, it's a little harder to tell a story because like technical stuff, it's either right or it's wrong. But what I've been trying to approach is applying that same sense of context around why an approach is right or wrong. If you look at things like JavaScript right now, a lot of the questions that you see asked are from younger developers who maybe haven't hit a particular set of edge cases or who haven't tried a particular approach that would make something like, you know, like Redux is kind of a constant argument, right? Should you use Redux? Should you not use Redux? And everybody has an answer, yes or no. And so then they're asking why. And the person who says yes, they have a great reason for why. They've thought through this, their response is articulate, but they typically don't offer that response. They don't offer the context. They just say, no, don't use it, or yes, do use it. When I'm teaching people how to do anything in software, what I'm attempting to do is create a minimized scenario that is real enough to be practical. So I'm not going to show you a Hello World example because the Hello World example is fine, but almost nobody is just building a little bit of text on a page. They're always trying to solve some kind of use case. So for example, one of the big tutorials I'm working on now is we wanted to create a story around user authentication. And I was like, okay, well, I can build a little Hello World example that makes a request to a REST API and then show you how that works, but it doesn't feel real. So I want you to understand why I'm doing this. So let's talk through a real example. So what I'm doing is I'm building our Gatsby swag store so that you can get t-shirts and socks and stuff like that. And then we're just going to open source that whole thing and write a series of articles about the reasons that we made the architectural decisions we made. And that's my way of trying to apply context to the problem. Well, we did it this way instead of this way, because in this particular use case, this would have caused a problem had we tried it this other way. And that's why we landed this way. So if you find yourself in a similar situation where you're trying to do this, then this is probably your best bet. And with that context, I've seen that junior developers tend to retain that information, and they tend to not want to go out and do things just because they can do them. They're solving problems they should be solving, not reinventing wheels because they don't agree with your opinion or the way you stated them.
Right. What I love about what you just described is it's not only a teaching application. So, you know, you're taking this problem that you're solving and you're sharing solutions as you come up with them. It sounds like it's really in the moment type stuff. Mm-hmm. And what's great is that's also a marketing strategy as well, because, you know, you're telling it in the moment and mm-hmm. learning really applicable things right now, as opposed to often what happens in marketing is like that past remembrance or reflection on what happened. And sometimes yeah. there's that incongruency between what happened and what the results were.
For sure. Yeah. And I think that you always get the bigger the distances between when the thing happened and when the thing was written about, the more revision there will be in that history. if I were to write about the Gatsby swag store in 6 months, we have 6 months of bug fixes and improvements in there. And I might leave out all of the dumb shit that I'm doing right now, that we will have to refactor later. And right. One of the things that I used to do, and this is maybe even more important than adding context, as a lead developer on my team at IBM, I would constantly try to do refactoring of my own code publicly. Mm-hmm. So I would grab my team and I'd say, hey, here's something stupid I did. Let's talk about why it's stupid, and then let's talk about how we can refactor this to be better and go through the anti-pattern and show that I'm not infallible. One of the things that bothers me the most about a lot of the thought leadering in JavaScript is that people present, and this is not true across the board, you know, there are many people who don't do this, but some of the thought leaders present as being like JavaScript gods. They always know the right way. They always have the right solution, and their code is very well debugged and tested. And, you know, it looks like they just birth this stuff whole onto Twitter and like you should feel terrible that you don't know how to do that. And I think that, you know, what I love about some of the people in the space do such a good job of like, I don't know, I have this like half-baked idea, I think this might work. And then they post about it and then they like reason through it over and over and over again. And it evolves over time as almost a community effort. And it shows that they're fallible. It shows that they make mistakes. And when they make a mistake, they own it. They're not like, oh, I'm so embarrassed that I did that. They're like, oh, yeah, so this was stupid, and here's why. Let's talk about a better way to do that. And I think that's so much more inclusive, and it's so much more welcoming to people who maybe don't feel super strong as developers. Mm. Like, we all suck at this, you know? Like, and there are certain things that I just cannot ever get right, that I'm constantly Googling or constantly like the first time I build it, it doesn't work and I have to rewrite the whole thing. And there are some things that I can do from memory because I've been doing this for a long time, but the experience of being bad at programming never goes away. Like whether you're a beginner and you're having to look up every single thing or whether you've been doing this for 15 years and you just have to look up the particularly weird stuff, like you're always going to suck at certain things. And I think that we shouldn't hide that away to present as experts. Like you can be an expert and simultaneously suck at this job. Like I think that's a constant state of being. Yeah. And I think we need to embrace that more. We need to let people know that like you don't have to clear this hurdle where nothing is ever hard. You have to clear the hurdle where you understand that it will always be hard, but you do know how to find the solution. Hmm.
I think sometimes that what that speaks to is a sense of permission, giving yourself permission to suck.
Yes.
And, So for yourself, what type of permission did you need to give yourself in order to suck, be a programmer, be a speaker, be a teacher?
I think it was like a series of small incremental permission. So, you know, at first it was, I give myself permission to be enough of a developer to show up at a local meetup. And, you know, I could walk into that room and not feel like I didn't belong there. And, you know, I think that barrier significantly lowered for me, because if I walk into a room full of white dudes, it's like, oh, he belongs. But, you know, it's still, there's that internal struggle of like, okay, I don't actually know how to program. So if I walk into this room full of programmers, am I a poser? Am I coming in here and like, they're just going to make me feel stupid or think that I'm stupid? So there was that initial step. And then after I was there for a little bit, I realized that, you know, some of the people there were about the same level as me, so I felt more comfortable. And then I was learning, so I got more experience. And then somebody asked a question that I actually knew the answer to. So I offered to do a little 15-minute presentation on how it worked. And I was like, oh, that was fun. And then people asked me about other stuff. And it turned out I knew the answer to some of that too. And the same with writing. I got an idea for a little thing, and I wrote it, and Chris Coyer was nice enough to post it. And it turns out it was terrible, full of security holes. Like, I was young, and again, I was trying to replace WordPress, right? So I was like, here's how to build your own simple CMS. And it was just a nightmare of bad code. And so then that was me having to, I could have either stopped there, or I had to give my permission. I had to give myself permission to fail. And so I had to be okay with screwing up, and I had to be okay with screwing up publicly. And for me, that it changed from being like permission to fail publicly to absolutely embracing public feedback. And I have an advantage in this. There's a personality test called the Caliper, which is used specifically in hiring. It's super expensive, so I wouldn't recommend trying to do it. But one of the things that they measure is your resilience. And my resilience scored in like the 99th percentile. So I'm very good at separating myself from my work. Wow. So I think that that's something that you build, because I do remember when I was young, like I wanted to be cool. And so I, at the time, shirts with Looney Tunes on the front were like the thing. You had to have them or you weren't cool. And I didn't have them, and that really bothered me. And so I begged my mom to get me a Looney Tunes shirt. And then by the time she got me one, was already not cool anymore. Like all the other kids had stopped doing it. So now I was uncool for wearing this shirt, and it crushed me. I wanted to like change schools. So I know I wasn't always resilient. I think that I learned it by very much trial by fire. Like I'd make a mistake in a talk I was giving at a local meetup. I had this huge mistake when I published this article on CSS tricks that went, you know, it like hit the front page of Dig and stuff. And so there was a big pile on it. Like, wow, this guy's a terrible programmer. And I had a couple big screw ups like that. I had that one, and that one was fixable. It was like, hey, you didn't approach security. And you know, the response to that is, yeah, this wasn't an article about security. And then I had a couple that were real bad. Like I had an article pulled off of Smashing Magazine because I was punching way above my weight. And it was very obvious that I didn't know what I was talking about. So they pulled the article, and I felt super embarrassed. And, you know, I'm like, it's been like 10 years and I'm still nervous to send anything over there because I think they're going to remember me. But so it's a sequence of that. Like each little thing that I did was a decision point. And I could say, okay, I can either be okay with doing this or I can stop here. And it's okay to stop. Like everybody's got their threshold where you get to a certain point, you go, okay, I think this is about as much as I really want to deal with. And I did that. Like I did that with my agency. I hit a point and I was like, you know what? I've had enough. This is not what I want to do. And so I backed away from it. And then with speaking, each incremental thing, speaking, teaching, writing, each thing that I've learned has been like, okay, I can do better than that. Like, this is still fun. Let's keep going. And so I take one extra step forward and then learn another thing. And it's one extra step forward. And so it's, it was definitely not like a single set of permissions. It was a really involved and long road of trying something, seeing a little bit of success or learning from a mistake, and then doing something a little bit better next time, and a little bit better the next time after that, and you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I'm just marveling at that story of resilience, because It's just like, it seems like whether you're a programmer, filmmaker, photographer, how you respond to the moments of failure really defines what you do next in a lot of ways. And I'm glad that you told that story, because I think everyone needs to hear that we all need to learn how to fail publicly, so that we can keep growing.
Yeah. And I don't even really feel like any of that is failure. I had this conversation with my partner, because she worked in human resources for years, and then she transitioned over to UX and like research a couple years back. And when she did that, she felt like she had wasted so much of her life, because she was like, well, I screwed up. I didn't follow what I wanted to follow. I did a thing that seemed safe, and now I've wasted all this time. And I was like, well, but that's not a failure. You learned so many things in that other role that are immediately applicable to what you do now. And that's very apparent in the fact that she went from being brand new to UX 3 years ago to last year she got promoted to the head of research at her company. So it was very clear that like a lot of her experience transferred over. You know, she's very smart, but nobody's that smart. You don't get 2 years of experience and qualify for that. She was pulling 7 years or 5 years of previous experience into that role. And it's mostly people skills. Like being good as a technical person is like, I know you can argue at what the breakdown is, but I promise you it's at least 50-50 people skills to technical skills.
Yes.
And most of the people I know who are in particularly prominent like management or leadership positions, their technical skills really aren't great. And it's their people skills that propelled them to this position, because they weren't great individual contributors. That took a weird turn. I started making one point and I ended up over here.
No, I think there's a lot of correlation between what you're saying of just, I think so often we think that being great at your job is all about your job. But what you're saying is it's your job plus people and how you activate people and engage with people.
And depending on what your goals are, you might even invert that. Your job is people plus the thing you do. Because, you know, if you want to be a programmer and you want to make real organizational change in any company that's larger than just you, having an idea is the easy part. The hard part is getting people to adopt it. The hard part is explaining it in a way that you're actually transferring that information and that context from your brain into someone else's in a way that they can repeat it without you. API design is one of the hardest things you can do, because basically what you're trying to do is you're figuring out a way that you can explain a concept so concisely and so perfectly that you walk away and everybody else can do the thing that you wanted them to do. That's people skills. That's communication. That's thinking about how am I emotionally affecting the people who use this API? Are they frustrated? Do they feel like they're getting superpowers? Do they feel like, you know, these are really important things. That was one of the reasons that I came over to Gatsby, actually, is because that's how it's being approached there. They're thinking about design from a people perspective. It's very much designed from the perspective of like, some of this stuff is hard. Like Gatsby really focuses on performance, and performance is traditionally one of the worst jobs, because typically it gets left to the last minute, so everything is a refactor. But also because a lot of this stuff is very confusing and it changes really fast. If you follow the space, you see like Adi Osmani is up talking about the purple pattern, and then you've got like Katie Siler-Miller is up talking about like the performance story at Etsy and all these things they learned and all this like very complicated adjustments that they're making, and then you've got like Tim Kavlik, and it's like it just keeps going. And so we were like, okay, well, what if we just took all of that and we turned that into a community hive mind and made it something so that you get to develop the stuff that you're supposed to be developing, like build a cool website, make a cool thing. And then we've designed it so that that stuff is all done well. The performance just happens out the back end. But that was, you know, the technology to make that work is readily available. Anybody can download a boilerplate that's got the purple pattern pre-configured and it's got code splitting from Webpack and all this stuff. Where I think Gatsby is doing a good job, and the reason that I wanted to join the team, is that they're thinking about it from the joy of programming. They're not thinking about it from the output of compiled code. And it, just that minor distinction, it means that they're approaching it from a people standpoint. And that's so critical to me. And I feel like that's where a lot of companies are missing Because, you know, we're going to get to the same output. Like, your really hard to use configuration for Webpack that you're forcing everybody on the team to learn and Gatsby give you the exact same result, but people enjoy using Gatsby and they hate messing with Webpack configuration.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's like objectively they're the same thing, but subjectively it's an entirely different experience.
Wow. That's super cool. Like, I love the way that you're able to describe an insanely technical topic humanly and emotionally, and where I don't feel, you know, I don't feel like I'm understanding you. It's excellent. Like I get it. It's great. I commend you for that. That's just excellent.
Thank you very much.
So as you're building a sustainable career, what systems do you have in place to help you do that?
I do a lot of personal monitoring to make sure that I'm within what I know my error bars are. Like, when I had my agency, one of the things that led me to break down on it was overworking. Mm. And so I was working 70 to 90 hours a week. So now I use an app called Rescue Time that sits in the background on my Mac and on my phone. And it just tells me at the end of the week how much screen time I had. Mm. And if I want to, I can get really technical and like bucket those things into different categories. I don't actually do that. I just look at the total number. And between my phone and my computer, I'm on a screen like 70 hours a week. But that includes everything. That's like my social media time, games, you know, how much time I spend watching TV. And that seems like a reasonably manageable. Like, I'd like that to be lower, but it seems like, okay, whatever. That's like 35, 40 hours of work and like 30 hours of screwing around on the internet. So, okay, whatever. That seems about fair for a human being. So I keep that in mind. If I see that creeping up higher, I'm like, okay, what's going on? And maybe I'll look and see like, oh crap, I worked 60 hours this week. I better chill. But like the last 2 weeks, I was in kind of a crunch mode because I'm building this Gatsby swag store. But I have friends in town today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. And so I was like, hey, what if I, like, I'll just put in some extra hours over the weekend so that today I can screw around.
Yeah.
So I'm going to, like, I'm talking to you. And once I get off this call, I'm out. I'm going. I'm going to go meet a friend for lunch.
That's awesome.
And so that's that's one of the ways that I try to keep tabs on things. And then, you know, you do. The other one is always trying to think about things from a sustainable, like, can I leave? The traditional term for this is like bus factor, like how many people on your team can get hit by a bus before a process breaks down. That's a super like negative way of looking at it. So I've been trying to reframe it as vacation tolerance. Like, what's your team's vacation tolerance? How many people can go on vacation before your team is stuck? And ideally, if you have a team of 10 people, you want your vacation tolerance to be 9. Because if you think about it, like, you're not going to be as productive if you've got a bunch of people out, but nobody should be stuck if somebody's missing. And especially if you're working in like a lead capacity, if you've got people who report to you, or if you're the tech lead on your team and like you've got junior developers who are looking to you for work. If you can't take a vacation, that is a huge problem, because what does that mean? Like, okay, your best friend's going to get married. You're going to be in the wedding. Are you going to shut down your company for 4 days, or are you going to try to work in the margins between the wedding activities? And I've seen people try to do both things. They leave and the company's like, all right, I guess like this whole team's on vacation because there's nothing we can do while this person's out. Or you've got somebody who's like standing up at the ceremony and then sprinting to the bathroom to answer Slack questions so that they can keep their team productive. And both of those are completely unhealthy ways to approach work. So what I've been doing, what I did at IBM when I was there, and what I'm trying to do at Gatsby as we're kind of ramping up the company, is we're thinking of everything that we do as a repeatable process. And the process, there's a really great quote. I wish I could remember her name. It's a woman who works at Automatic, and she said, whose process kind of brings up this like negative connotation, like a process. I don't want to fill out forms. But this woman at Automatic, she said, engineers actually love process. The difference is when they love a process, they don't call it a process. They call it culture. And so when you think about it from that perspective, that's 100% true. So we're building processes constantly in every company that we have. The difference is it can be a designed process, or it can be a naturally occurring process. And sometimes a naturally occurring process is great, like small groups who kind of naturally land on a democracy, like a democratic way of decision making. It's a great process. Like, that's a good way to do things. But if the natural process is, Susan knows everything, so you should check with her, then that's fine until Susan wants to leave. Mm-hmm. And then when she takes that vacation, we're all like, oh, I guess we can't do anything on that until Susan gets back. Or you end up like calling her in the middle of her vacation to try to get some information. And so basically, instead of allowing those natural processes to occur, because we're always designing a process, we try to be more deliberate about what we're doing. Okay, what am I doing, and how can I make sure that somebody else on my team who has no context for this project could come in and look at what I've done and have a doc to follow that would say, hey, you can look through this stuff. And usually that just means like we have an, like the way that we've done it is we set up ZenHub, which is a free plugin for GitHub. And it gives you like Kanban boards, but more importantly, because projects in GitHub give you Kanban boards, you get epics with ZenHub, which is like, it's an agile terminology, but basically what it means is like issues with sub issues. Hmm. And so we collect, like, any project has an epic as like the major overarching thing. And we just collect stuff that's relevant to that. Oh, this project has a Gantt chart. Here's a link to it. This project has like all of these issues that need to be worked. Here's where we keep, you know, for the store. Here's where we're tracking inventory. Here's where the emails are. Here's where you can find the docs with like contacts for our different vendors. Those sorts of things. Like, it's not like a rigid step-by-step checklist. It's just a collection of information that says, this is what we do and here's how we do it, so that somebody can walk in with no context and then move on. So with that, like checking in with myself and then making sure that I'm not accidentally designing bad processes, that helps keep things pretty functional. And it helps avoid a lot of that kind of like pressure on me to always be present, or the stress for the other teams because they feel like they have no idea what's going on. And they're just kind of like, I'm this like bottleneck off in the corner that like, yeah, things happen, but if I die, like, is the company dead? That's you want to make sure that you avoid that in all cases. So that's been a big focus for us.
Fascinating. Thank you. I love the personal and then the business touch there. That's great. It sounds like you have a lot of things dialed in with your life, which is really cool and admirable, but what's one struggle that you have to consistently work through?
I mean, all of that is a constant struggle because it's stuff that I understand objectively, but when you're talking about any type of habit, the Chip and Dan Heath wrote a book called Switch, and one of the concepts they talk on in there is it's the concept of the elephant and the rider. And so the rider is your logical mind. It's the part that I've been speaking to you from this whole time. It's all the ideas that I know work, that I know are correct. But then there's the rider. And so the rider is the part of you that when your logical brain says, yeah, we're going to go to the gym and we're going to get healthy. And then the elephant is the part that after a long day, like goes on autopilot, gets a pint of ice cream and just turns on Netflix. So the trick, the hardest part for me with all of this is making sure that you're designing this stuff from an emotionally viable standpoint. Because if you don't, like the mantra I have around this is make the right thing the easy thing. Hmm. Because all of us have a limited source of willpower, and all of us eventually get lazy. So what I want is if I've designed my goal, like the high bar for me is a process that's so well designed that when you do the laziest possible solution to your problems, it's the right solution. I want you to get through that problem and get to the other end of it, and the right thing has come out that other side. And that's a very emotional design process because now you're not thinking about, oh, well, the software is objectively correct. You're thinking like, okay, it's objectively correct, but like, is it easier to do it this way than it would be to skip all of my guardrails and check in something terrible? And you know, that I have to do the same thing in all of my processes because like I go to the gym, right? But I don't like to go to the gym, and I'm very, very good at finding reasons not to go to the gym. So I had to make the right thing the easy thing. I hired a personal trainer, not because I actually think I need one, but because if I don't have somebody waiting for me who's going to be disappointed if I don't show up, I won't go. So now the easy thing for me is to show up because it's harder for me to call somebody and to disappoint them than it is to just go to the gym. So I made the right thing the easy thing by putting that pressure on myself. And I try to do that all over the place. Like I want to be able to take a vacation, but I will not take a vacation if the process isn't clear enough that somebody else can follow without me. Mm-hmm. So now the pressure is on me in the right way. The right thing is to document the process. And the easy thing, because I don't want to have to take a call when I'm out, when I'm out trying to do something fun, is to document the process. it's just trying to get that alignment.
Yeah.
And it personally and professionally. And that is a constant struggle that I'm constantly screwing up.
Well, it's super cool the way you're describing it too, because it's speaking to how you approach learning new things. Mm-hmm. And to me, it sounds like you approach learning new things from the mind of a scientist, where you experiment in everything and see what the results are and then shift accordingly.
Yeah, I think that would be a kind way of saying it. I think the more accurate way is that I've like flailed around and made a lot of mistakes. And the positive attribution I will give myself, because I wasn't methodical in this. Like, it's not like I sat down and said, hey, let's try this approach and then this approach and then this approach. What I did do, though, is as I was flailing, when I saw an approach, I would think about why it didn't work. And then I would try to apply that to my next approach so that I at least wasn't repeating myself. There's that old cliche, like the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Mm-hmm. And so I've tried to internalize that in my approach to everything, just to make sure that, like, yes, I'm going to be wrong, and I'm going to be wrong probably more often than not, but hopefully I won't be wrong in the same way twice.
Just taking that in. That's great. What's one book or resource that has impacted your life? You talked a little bit about Hemingway and some of the early writers that you dove into, but mm-hmm. is there a book that you come back to that you're like, wow, that one right there?
Oh man, there are so many good ones. One of the ones that I just recently reread that I just love it. I don't even know if it's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Nice.
It's just such a good book about thinking. And I've always loved that. And in the more like practical realm, the Heath brothers have written some amazing stuff, the Made to Stick and Switch and all that. They're kind of talking about not only designing, Made to Stick is kind of about marketing. How do you get an idea to stick in somebody's head? But Switch is all about emotional design. How do you get somebody to change their mind? Some books that were super influential for me recently. So I can't say that they changed the way that I've thought about things for the last 2 years or so. It's one called How Not to Be Wrong. I think the subtitle is The Power of Mathematical Thinking. And it takes math and kind of breaks down the way that we make decisions and then talks about, like, we've already worked out ways to solve these decisions optimally. And if we know, then we can actually kind of apply that. Another couple that I read that were like, they started me on an existential tailspin, and then it ended up ultimately being a good thing. I read, it was a trilogy actually. So the first one I read was Sapiens. And Sapiens is kind of like a loose history of humanity from, pre-agricultural days to now. And after that, I read a book called Spent. And Spent is a history of consumerism. And where it comes from and kind of how it's evolved over time. And then I read one called The Authenticity Hoax. And The Authenticity Hoax is basically predicated on the idea that anything that we would consider authentic is something that has been marketed particularly well, and it's not authentic at all. And so those three books basically undermine everything that I thought about value and about what, like, how to make decisions about what's valuable or what I should be focusing on. And it was real dark for a minute because it really is. It's like, oh yeah, everything you believe is completely wrong and backwards. And basically you're just doing stupid monkey shit because you don't know any better. so that was like kind of soul crushing, but then out the other side, it's like nihilism. Like at first it's like, okay, well, nothing matters and everything is terrible. But if you keep reading and you get through to the other side of it, what that actually means is you're actually very free, because if you think about it, if nothing matters and everything ends and we're all doomed anyways, then that means that we're free to assign any meaning that we want and pursue only that meaning. I'm not bound by your sense of value or your sense of purpose. I'm only bound by my own. And so it starts out pretty dark, but out the other end, it's actually super hopeful because it removes this external pressure. Of course, this is treading some delicate philosophical ground here, so I'll back away from it gently after this.
No worries. I think it's awesome.
Yeah. Anyways, that's a really good trilogy. And then the other ones that I mentioned as well are excellent reads.
Awesome. Well, final question for you. Mm-hmm. What's one thing in the future you are actively working to make happen today?
Whew. My current, you want professionally or personally?
Just
or?
Whatever. I mean, the kind of that big idea that you're working toward professionally, personally.
Mm. So my current big idea is I want to make Gatsby into a company that is used as a model for startups. And I'm trying to do that by, and like, it's not just me. It's not like the company's fighting this. We're all very interested in this. And we're trying to do that by process design. We're trying to do that by publishing the meta story of how we're building the company. Like I said, you know, we're building a swag store right now. And part of building that swag store is writing a UX story about why it was important in the first place, writing the dev story of how we built it, publishing the code so that other people can do the same thing. We're doing that meta story thing, and then we're trying to think about it from the like long-term impact. So Gatsby is super powerful for like making a website load in under 3 seconds on 3G. Like that's the initial value prop. And that's the thing that all the big companies want because Google told them that if it takes longer than 3 seconds, they lose half their customers. Mm. That's a scary statistic. So yes, we do that. But the other thing that we do is, for example, like there's this huge developer culture in Nigeria right now. And there's this huge developer culture emerging in Southeast Asia. And though they're going to be the next billion users. And somebody, I love this quote, somebody said, Africa is the next billion users and the next million builders. And I love it. It's so good. and so something that we do, like a lot of those areas are on 2G connections, right? So if it takes 3 seconds to load on 3G, you can imagine how slow it is on 2G. And like a lot of the sites right now are taking, I think the average for the internet is 15-ish seconds to load on 3G. But we never noticed that because we live in the United States and typically we're on 4G or a wired connection. So we've got, you know, we're loading these 15 megabyte monsters like CNN, I think transfers 30 megabytes if you leave it open for 30 minutes. Wow. Like it's just gross. Like, you know, the adware running in the background and all this blocking crap that comes in and just, it makes the internet so slow. You put that in a 2G context, it's basically unusable. So one of the things that I'm really excited about with Gatsby is that we're building stuff that automatically gets you a lot of the way there for building internet for feature phones on 2G connections. So we're trying to push the world forward. Like I want the next million builders to have tools to reach those next billion users without requiring the infrastructure to be rebuilt around them. I want them to be able to use the infrastructure they have now to deliver a fantastic experience on the internet. And not, you know, the internet is paid by the megabyte over there. So you would burn 3 or 4 of your megabytes just to load like one website. You load Mashable, it's like 2 or 3 megabytes. So you to look at that from the standpoint of, okay, you load, so somebody who's done a great job of this is Harry, CSS Wizardry. His site is like 300 kilobytes and it loads in like 1 second. It's,
wow.
It's just so fast. And he built that by hand. Right. So it's all hand tuned. Everything on it is very, very perfectly tuned for his use case. A Gatsby site, on the other hand, is built more one size fits all. And like my site, I think is 400 kilobytes or something, and it loads in like 2 seconds. So I didn't do any hand tuning. I just spun up Gatsby. I was like, all right, go. And so I think, but that I think is the strength of it. And that's, you know, you don't have to be an expert. You just get this tool and it does a thing. And so, the process, the meta, the potential to go outside of our own sphere and bubble and help a group of people that are typically kind of ignored by a lot of modern tech. That to me seems like a very cool story to try to build a company that, you know, we can be very proud of on multiple levels. And so that's like my big project right now is trying to make sure that we're always in service of that goal.
Power to you. That is an awesome goal. That's great. Seriously. I mean, I'm just loving that quote that Africa is the next billion users and the next million builders.
I love it. Find that tweet and send it to you because it's a real good one.
Thank you. Well, Jason, where can people learn more about you and find your awesome 400K website?
So my website's at langsdorf.com. I guess check show notes for how to spell it. I'm on Twitter, GitHub, all those as Jay Langsdorf. And you know, you can reach out to me about anything. You want to talk tech, you want to talk whatever. I love talking about this stuff, as you probably noticed, and I will do it to anyone who's willing to listen. So
awesome.
I'd love to talk to you.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. It's been an absolute pleasure. And just thank you for the way that you show up and you make people think about what it means to be a human in this technical world that we live in. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Chris. This is I love talking about this stuff. And usually people just want to talk about the real nitty-gritty technical parts. So this is super fun.
Awesome. That does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It means so much to me that you do. Would you be willing to share Getting Work to Work with your friends, other creative professionals, and entrepreneurs? You can send them to gwtw.co or have them search for Getting Work to Work on most podcast platforms. Would you like to be a guest on a future episode of Getting Work to Work or know someone who should be on the show? Maybe you need some advice or just want someone to say hi to. Drop me a line by sending me an email. I'm chris@chrismartinstudios.com, or you can find me on Twitter. I'm @CMStudios. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.